Show us your fucking hands now.
Stand up.
Stand up. Stand up.
Stand up now. Stand up.
Stand the fuck up.
Get your hands.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. On the 15th of June 2023, 911 dispatchers received a call. It was at 4:15 p.m. and it is harrowing. Basically, a woman is screaming that her babies had been shot. So automatically, you're dragged in to this nightmare that's playing out in reality. And for the dispatcher who's on the phone, it's something that happens, but it's very unusual. And statistically, to be the person who actually takes the call, where somebody is telling that call handler that something terrible is happening to her children, that's going to be rare in nature. And actually, I've listened to the 911 calls that have been brought in by neighbours in this case. And even then, you can hear that the call handlers really don't quite understand what's playing out. And they're trying to come to terms with it themselves. And that's because it is so unique to deal with this kind of horror in real time. So these calls come in, and this involves the actual people being directly affected, the mother in this case, but also residents of rural Claremont County, Ohio, which is where this crime plays out. They make 911 calls too. They can hear gunshots at a neighbor's home in Monroe Township, which is just 20 miles east of Cincinnati. And they are actually telling the call handlers, there's this young girl, she's running down the street, and she's screaming that her stepfather is killing everyone in their family.
911, where's your emergency?
There's a girl running down the street saying that her stepfather is killing everyone in her family. It's on the corner of where there's a body shop and the fire department. Do you know what road this is?
Okay, what's your name?
Give it to the fire department.
What's your name?
Do you know what road this is? Laura Lindell Road.
What?
It's Laura Lindell Road.
Okay, and what did the female say to you?
And she says that her stepfather is killing everybody in her house. I did. I'm on the phone with them right now.
Did you say how or what was happening?
I asked her to get in the car with me, and she said she couldn't leave her family. But I think she ran to the fire department.
So she went to the fire station. What did she look like?
She's probably a young teenager, probably like 15, 16 maybe, with long blonde hair. She has a black dog.
Did she say anything about a baby?
I don't know about no baby. She said she just couldn't leave her family.
The caller in one case actually says, listen, this girl was obviously in a distraught state. I wanted her to stay with me, but she just said that she needed to look after her family. She's basically running towards some kind of fire department, potentially looking to get some help off them. And this speaks of volumes of courage. This child who is essentially escaping and also trying to help deal with a situation that is affecting her direct family, knowing that her brothers and her mother are in the eye of the storm and ultimately trying her best to do everything that she can to bring help to them. But you can imagine the chaos that is unfolding. And to be an individual who is seeing that happen, it's really hard to digest because we live in this society where for the most part, we feel relatively safe. And even though things go wrong in our neighborhoods, to all intents and purposes, we kind of assume this bias of security. So when somebody starts using language such as my stepfather is killing my entire family, just computing it is incredibly challenging. So this is about the people who are all witnessing this play out, having to come to terms with everything that they knew about their area, just dissolving in front of their eyes because this is unspeakable terror and unspeakable loss all playing out. Now, understandably, officers are dispatched. They arrive at the home around 4:30 p.m. And even then, when you're watching this on body cam footage, you can connect that for the officers, they understand that something dreadful is meant to have happened, but coming to terms with just how gruesome the discovery is going to be is something that is unbelievably challenging for each of the officers. And you can hear the way that they are actually breathing, the way that they are speaking in those moments, the way that they're trying to piece the puzzle together as they come to terms with what they're about to see. Because the murder scene that greets them is literally something that law enforcement very rarely have to deal with, but it's something that's going to stay in their conscience for the rest of their lives as officers. You're never, ever going to forget what they had to see. Because as they come up, noticing that there is the person who's no doubt the perpetrator sat down, they can't help but see three small boys who've all been laid out on the lawn, all shot, execution style. They're all lying on the front yard. Those boys were 3-year-old Chase, 4-year-old Hunter, and 7-year-old Clayton Doman. Absolutely beautiful children. And they were absolutely gorgeous little boys. Apparently very close friends, very connected siblings. So we're talking about three little boys together who loved one another, were always there for each other. That's what so many people talk about when it comes down to this family, that these little boys were genuinely a family of brothers who just adored one another. And we know that we go through changes as we develop, adolescence can be a problem, but to be honest, when you have those early connections, it speaks as something that in the future is going to look beautiful. The opportunity to be close siblings and to watch as one another succeeds in life and to celebrate those wins and to have families and share those families with one another. And we're talking about all of that potential being absolutely wiped out in moments. You can also here on the body cam footage, the poor mother in this situation, Laura Dorman. She's shouting, "You took my life from me, my life." And she is distraught beyond belief. Because what we are witnessing is a mother who has just lost three of her babies in the most unspeakable ways at the hands of somebody that she absolutely loves. She is dealing with that in that moment. When that body cam footage is recording her, it is her moment of unspeakable grief being seen and being connected with. And don't get me wrong, sometimes I think, you know, is that right that we see this kind of information, that we see people and hear people in their most terrified of states, in the most terrible states? But actually what we're sharing there is the feeling that we have of empathy. So when I don't see her, because obviously she's covered in the video, but you hear her, all you feel is this connection and this desire to soothe this woman and to share the pain that she's going through. And the fact that she's saying, "You took my life," she's absolutely right. Because anybody who loses their children that way knows that ultimately part of who they are has died. It will never be recovered. I appreciate that people create amazing legacies when they lose people that they love and they make an impact on the world that is often very positive. But come on, you know that you are literally losing a huge chunk of who you are, and everything that your life has been till that point is going to change. It will be unrecognizable from that moment. There was life before tragedy and there was life without tragedy, and you never look the same. Your reflection is a different reflection from that moment onwards. She had actually been injured as well. She'd actually tried, as we would imagine a loving mother would do, to intervene. She wanted to protect her boys, but the hand injury that she'd received, it wasn't life-threatening, but understandably, she's going to be in absolute shock. She's physically injured. She's emotionally broken beyond belief, but she's with her boys. She didn't run from them. She didn't hide from what was playing out. She confronted it. She's a woman of absolute courage, and I know that everybody's heart will go out to her just hearing about this case today. It's some of the most traumatic body cam that I have ever seen, because one of the things that you note is the difference between her as the mother and the man who's the perpetrator in this, which is the father of those three boys, Chad Dorman. He's 32 years of age. He's sitting on the front steps of the home when the officers arrive. Understandably, the officers want to know whether he's armed. They're shouting commands to him. He doesn't actually do what they're saying, so they get a bit more loud and a bit more aggressive. In the end, they have to grab him. They have to pull him away. He's actually got the rifle that he'd used to kill the boys at his side. But he then very calmly says to them, "I ain't going to hurt nobody. I'm completely sober. don't get me wrong, how many times have we been in situations where people can say that they're not under the influence and it turns out that they are? So we don't have to take it as absolute truth that he isn't under the influence of anything. But to all intents and purposes, the way that he comes across is compos mentis. He wants the police officers to know that he's not going to go fighting. He wants the officers to know that he isn't actually carrying any weapons. And he's saying, you know, he's going to comply. He's also acknowledging what he has done in that moment.
What are you doing, man?
Are you copying all this?
Can I roll over? I ain't gonna hurt you. I ain't gonna hurt nobody.
You got anything on you?
No, I ain't got nothing, man. Phone, that's it. I ain't mad, I ain't nothing. Just make sure that dog don't come out. I don't think he'll bite you. Just don't reach for him and try to grab him and pet him.
All right.
He won't bite you.
What's going on, man?
Nothing. Can I stand up? It's kind of uncomfortable.
I'm gonna get you.
I ain't running away. You can do whatever you want with me.
And I suppose from my outside looking in professionally, from the therapeutic world that I've grown up in and that I've trained in, there is something a little bit unusual about the way that he is acting, because even though he is admitting to what he has done, which is a good thing because we absolutely want people to take responsibility for their actions, there is something still, in my opinion, that appears a little bit detached. Now, he's understandably arrested by police at that moment in time. He actually says to them, "Tell them I did it, take me to jail." He's shouting whilst he's being detained in the back of the police cruiser, all of these things that say basically, "I'm the person, I'm bang to rights." The first responders, they attempted life-saving measures, as the mother had in this case, but all three of them were declared dead at the scene. It was completely hopeless. There was absolutely no way that any of them could have survived the injuries. And Laura Dorman, she is also somebody who suffered. She's got the wound to the hand, so she ends up getting taken to the University of Cincinnati Medical Center. This is where she's treated. I cannot imagine how she would manage breathing in the moments that she's separated from the children that she adored when she has to receive that treatment. I cannot begin to conceive of the shock that she will have been enduring during those moments. Now, Dorman gets taken to jail, then he's interviewed by police. It was around 2.5 hours that he was interviewed for. He confesses to the murders. Of course he does, because let's be honest, he's been seen killing these children. He's the only person who's in the crosshairs regarding being the suspect. He's also admitted it, but nonetheless, there have been witnesses, including his stepdaughter, who was running through the street saying, "My stepfather is killing my brothers." So without a shadow of a doubt, he's going to get caught, going to get charged, and going to get found guilty of these crimes, no matter what he says. Now, during the interview, there are some concerning statements that he makes. So he claims to have connections with the CIA. He also says that his wife had poisoned him. And I suppose immediately that brings us into a position where we can start questioning his mental health to some degree. He looks completely together. He seems and appears to be, when the police on the body cam connect with him and take him in, to be calm and to be compos mentis regarding his environment. He understands what he's done. But when he's in that interrogation, if he's actually talking about his wife potentially poisoning him, that speaks of some level of paranoia and suspicious thoughts. And when we think about delusional belief systems, which play into things like psychosis, that certainly would suggest that there could potentially be something on a deeper level going on with him.
Did you shoot your son?
Yeah.
Who did?
Howard Gilbert.
He also, in that interview, says to the police, "Look, I've been planning these executions for months," and that he was so fixated on planning killing these absolutely beautiful little boys that he'd actually been struggling to sleep because he'd been going through this in his mind. He'd been ruminating over it. Apparently he'd been thinking about killing his boys since the October. Understandably, the police charge him. He gets charged with 3 counts of aggravated murder. He's taken to Claremont County Jail. This is where he's held, understandably, without the possibility of bond, because this appears to have happened out of the blue. And there is nothing more dangerous than an individual who, to all intents and purposes, has been a relatively pro-social human being and then can carry out such an attack. If you let them out of prison, you have absolutely no idea what they are going to be capable of, and certainly they could be a risk to other people's lives. Now, one of the things that happened is the statements that were taken in that interview where he admits everything, they were later ruled inadmissible. Now, the reason for that is the judge said that the detective did not properly advise Doerman of his rights and also failed to end the interview when Doerman asked for a lawyer. And even though this is a clear bang to rights case where he is going to find himself being dealt the heavy hand of the law, and rightfully so, it also makes sense that you have to follow protocol. It's deeply frustrating and aggravating when investigators don't follow the line of the law, because that can lead to cases being thrown out. And certainly, ultimately, when we're dealing with cases as serious as this, we want people to be charged accordingly and tried accordingly. But I can also have a level of sympathy and empathy for the person dealing with the interrogation. I cannot begin to imagine the psychological shift a detective has to make, no matter what they've seen in their life, but what they have to do to actually accept the fact that they are sitting in front of a man who has apparently coldly and calmly executed three absolutely beautiful children out of the blue. So for somebody to gather their thoughts, even if you're a consumer professional, you can go through your entire career always dealing with things perfectly, and then something changes, and the things that you always just took for granted and felt second nature, they just dissolve, because you're trying to figure out what's actually happened here. Who am I talking to? And the rush, potentially, to get this guy to say what he needs to say so that this man can throw the book at him, that's probably the pursuit of truth that this guy is going for, and it trips him up to a point where he doesn't follow a process. And that's a big problem, and understandably, that's why it's thrown out. But I do have, like I say, a level of sympathy and empathy for the interrogator. He's probably blindsided beyond belief. Now, after this interrogation, when he's held without the opportunity of bond, he tells a mixed bag of stories. So at times he's talking about the fact that he absolutely remembers nothing of the shooting, but then he speaks to his family and he tells them a different story. So in a jail phone call to his mother, for example, he says, "No, I remember everything all the way to all the reasons why and everything." So he's telling one set of people, the detectives, for example, one particular set of circumstances, and he's telling others, his family indeed, that no, he remembers every single moment of what he did and why he did it. Now, that could, again, be considered, well, he's a liar, he's a sociopath, psychopath, and therefore we cannot take anything that he says as truth. Equally, it can be that he has different stories for different people based on the psychological distress that he might be encountering. And by the way, you all know me by now. There's no way I'm going to be saying that psychological distress is an excuse to go ahead and execute your children. I'm saying that it's intriguing to look at the way that he presents himself in life, because even though very often people who are dealing with delusional scenarios, it's very clear to see that they're dealing with delusional scenarios because their behaviour seems quite outlandish or terrifying, you can also have individuals that go quite withdrawn. So they seem to be calm, they seem to be computing the world around them, they seem to be compos mentis, but actually it's a guard because they're deeply suspicious of the world around them. So it could be that when he's speaking to his family, he's telling one set of circumstances based on the less suspicious nature that he has in those moments, and with others, where he feels that he has to have the guard up, he's telling the other types of circumstances and describing what happened in that scenario where he's saying, "I didn't actually understand what was playing out. I don't remember what happened at all." So like I said, it might be that he's an absolute liar. It might be that there is something going on a more mental health level. Now, he is in prison for the first 12 days and then he gets a jailhouse visit with his brother. When he's having that visit with his brother, because bear in mind, Doerman is somebody who is very much loved by his family, and this is so out of character as far as they are concerned. So his brother comes and sees him, and at this point, Doerman compares himself to Hitler. And the way it's expressed is that Hitler made global news, and so did he, and he doesn't allegedly express any remorse. Now again, that puts us into a territory where we'd be saying cold-blooded killer, psychopathic actions, an individual with a lack of empathy. But equally, we could say, well, what the family are noting is this is so outlandish behaviour-wise. This is so far away from the doorman that they know, that you can't help consider the idea and possibility that something is interplaying in his psychology. Again, it's not excusing his behaviour in any way, shape or form, just exploring how somebody can go from being an individual that most people have got good words to say about to a person that very few people can even conceive of being given the grace to breathe again. Because for most people, the idea that he even gets to carry on his life after carrying out these kind of actions feels inconceivably unfair. The idea that he's not expressing remorse as well, that can feel a little bit strange. Because if you've gone ahead and murdered your children, and there is something going on for you psychologically, such as you are a psychopath, well, the easiest way to seem less evil is to act like you have a shred of remorse. That's one of the reasons that we see psychopaths being liars, because even though they don't do it well, they can at least try to feign a level of sadness because they think it looks better for them when they're dealing with court cases, for example. But that isn't playing out with his own brother. So it just speaks of something unusual about his behaviour. Now, Chad Doman's father, Keith Doman, he said that he is absolutely stunned by what's happened. He's heartbroken, understandably. He's lost his three grandsons. And he said that he doesn't have the exact explanation for what happened. He just believes his son snapped. He said, "I could tell in his eyes, he's hollow inside. That wasn't Chad standing at the arraignment. That was not him. I don't know if it was financial. I don't know if it was mental. I don't know if it was work related. I don't know." He said, "I can't talk to him." He then talked about the fact that his son was a really fun-loving guy. He said he was a good kid. He said he was a super father. And he said, "It's awful. I cannot handle this anymore." So this is a seemingly ordinary man carrying out extraordinarily evil actions. And the duality of that for the people who know Chad Doman is incredibly challenging to manage because it's cognitive dissonance. I love him. He's a good guy. He's murdered his children. They don't connect. The interplay is just so wide apart that you cannot connect the two. How can Chad Doman be a good guy, a super father, a lovely man, and also an evil, malevolent force who has literally wiped out a generation of children who deserved so much more? He was somebody, people say, who was always quite quiet. So listening to some of his ex-schoolmates talk about him, they say that Chad Doman was an individual who wasn't massively popular. He certainly wasn't a dark-natured individual at school, but he was somebody who was quite quiet. He was quite introspective, but there was nothing that stood out about him that would lead anybody to believe that he had the capacity and capability to do what I've described so far. He led a quiet life in a small Ohio town. He actually worked full-time as an insulator, so he was able to hold down full-time work. And people who knew him, both as a young person and also those who were friends and neighbours, they said he was very reserved. He was a very private person, but he wasn't somebody that stood out as a problem. Now, a neighbour who did actually witness the aftermath of the shooting, they said that he'd seen Doman treat both his wife and his children poorly. Richard Kincannon, he actually was quoted as saying he was angry every day. There wasn't a day he didn't yell at his wife and kids out there. He went on to say Doman had a temper. He said yelling at the kids all the time and treating his wife like shit. Now that's what somebody in first person testimony has said about what they have seen about Doman and the way that he treats the people that he's meant to love. And that could indeed be 100% accurate. What you could also say, because there are a lot of conflicting views about where people are saying that he's a decent man, is that if you are a neighbour who've seen this family and then you find out that this man has executed the most beautiful children, every tiny moment that you might have kept as a memory about this person being less than perfect over the years is potentially going to amalgamate and you're going to make them into a monster in that moment because you just can't actually compute that this human being could be okay and then go ahead and kill in this way that I'm talking about today. So ultimately, when they go ahead and do something like family annihilation, that person looks and thinks, ooh, they weren't very nice sometimes, and makes it an all the time scenario. Having said that, it could be that that particular neighbour genuinely saw things that other people didn't notice, because neighbours do. We're all a bit on the nosy side, aren't we? It's not just me. It's not just me. I know that a lot of us are curtain twitchers. It's as simple as that. If there's a noise outside, there's a little bit of shouting, there's a little bit of things going on in the street. For example, just down my road not so long ago, a man had an armed raid. He had to come out in his underpants. There were armed police and everything. It's exciting. It's a little bit strange as well. I live in a very suburban place where these kind of things don't happen. A lot of my neighbours are pensioners. To be honest, it was the most exciting thing that had happened to us in quite a while. The point is, we all were talking about what had been going on and trying to figure out who he was. I've got him down as a drugs mule. It's as simple as that. Some kind of kingpin, potentially, even. Whatever. The point is this. We all know that as neighbours, we see things sometimes that family members don't see. And that could equally be what's happened here, that this neighbour has noted things that other people have not seen about Doorman. Now, he had had some contact with police previously, but most of those offences actually were traffic incidents. I suppose one could say, well, you know what? Traffic incidents mean that somebody has poor impulse control. There'll be loads of you out there going, I'm sorry, Emma, I've been done for speeding 3 times and have perfect impulse control. What I'm saying is, there are those of us who toe the line of the law, right? Like, I have never had a traffic violation. I have never been caught for speeding because I never do it because I am pathetic that way. I just have this mindset where I'm like, that's what I'm going to do because I've been told to do it. And there are other people, like my husband and one of my sons, who, I don't know, didn't get the memo on that. And so they do have traffic violations. And so it means that when it comes down to who is more likely to act in an impulsive manner, the people who broke the law, albeit a small law, are more likely to have a more impulsive reaction. And that makes them lovely, spontaneous human beings as well. And it doesn't mean that they're going to go and annihilate the family. I'm just bringing down to the level of psychologically, how do we connect somebody who seems to only have things like traffic violations and then actually amplify that to a position where their psychology allows them to brutalize their children in this way? And it could be that it's giving us an insight into him not being able at times to contain himself. That's why he gets these violations. Also in 2010, there's an incident that certainly is problematic. So he's charged with domestic violence. And the reason for that, he's accused of choking his father. Now, this case was ultimately dismissed. His dad did say down the line, look, it was genuinely just a misunderstanding. And I suppose you can give them the benefit of the doubt in that situation. The father knows what played out, and Chad Doorman may have just got really angry and gone for his father, but not actually intended any great harm. We could also say it talks about a latent violence within this man, a latent violence that is festering, a latent violence that he can control for the most part. But just like in any situation, you have to look at most of us and how we act. And most of us and how we act isn't to violently assault a parent by grabbing them by the throat, no matter what the misunderstanding is. Now, when you look on Chad Doorman's social media, so like Facebook pages, he presents himself as a really fun-loving father. In fact, his profile picture was a picture of his sons with a monster truck. He seems devoted. I'm going to be really honest with you. That's what you see on social media. But how often do we see the myth of the men who are monsters looking like they are the smiling, great human beings and mentors we would all want around our children, only to find out the sadists that lurk beneath? One of the things that is clear again on those social media profiles is that the Doorman boys were just good friends. They were real pals. They were always supporting one another. And don't get me wrong, listen, there is nothing going to make up for this horror that I am talking about today. It has broken my heart doing this case. Every single child death breaks my heart. But when I'm talking about a triple homicide of the most beautiful children, the most loved children, it is just something that splinters me into a million pieces, as it does you. And the one thing that I hold on to is that every single one of them is together, and wherever they are in this beautiful universe and the big beautiful beyond, they are still supporting one another. And I truly hold on to that. I truly believe that. Bear in mind, there had actually been no prior disturbances that had been reported to the authorities regarding the Dorman household that were deeply problematic, that really stood out. But in the days leading up to the murders, I would say that there were warning signs that something was going wrong in Chad Dorman. So in the days before he carries out these horrendous executions, and that's the word that we have to associate with Dorman, he executed each of his children. And bear in mind that when we talk about exactly how this plays out, two of those boys witnessed the first killing. One of those boys witnessed two of the killings before ultimately he lost his life. So we're talking about unspeakable horror. But in the days before those murders, Dorman actually takes his sons to a local dirt track race. He takes them fishing. When the police spoke to his co-worker said, look, there was absolutely nothing alarming about his behaviour. But there is an incident that was described as unusual just the day before the murders took place. So apparently he woke up his stepdaughter, Alexis, in the morning. And he then apologised to her for anything he'd ever done to hurt her. That same night, Dorman then went and coached the base for Clayton's baseball team. So he's woken up with kind of a mindset where he's apologising for who he's been, apologising to Alexis for falling short. I would imagine there's something going on psychologically within him where he's trying to let her know that he recognises he's erred in some way. And the fact that he can do that, but then carry on about his business and go and coach baseball again, it speaks of this duality in his nature. But of course, that's a retrospective recollection. That's what you start piecing together after an event has played out. We've all done that. We've all been in situations where something has happened. And once it's happened, you're like, oh my God. Now I look back and I think, they said this, they did this. In my own case of watching my father with psychosis and ultimately him killing himself, I can go back and say, yeah, he was looking at belts really strangely in Marks and Spencer's, the shop where they went and bought clothes. It felt like he was testing how strong the belts were. But on reflection, that's something that makes sense because I know ultimately what happened. During that experience, I was thinking he's just looking for a really strong belt because he likes a good quality leather belt. So retrospective hindsight is always 20/20 vision. So piecing that together after we fast-forwarded past the event and looking back on it, of course, apologising for things that you've done and trying to make good and make peace with somebody that you might have harmed, that can give you an insight into what was going on. Ultimately, were they thinking about also potentially taking their life? And I do genuinely think that Chad Dorman is potentially thinking about his own mortality and wanting to end his own life and potentially his children's lives at the same time when he's having that conversation. Chad Dorman was charged with 9 counts of aggravated murder, 8 counts of kidnapping and 4 counts of felonious assault. As I said, his bond was impossible, essentially, because he was given a $20 million bond. So basically that means he didn't make bond at all. The entire case just completely stunned the county. Prosecutors called it one of the most heinous crimes in Claremont County history. And the prosecutors then told the story, essentially, of exactly what happened the days that the boys were murdered. They talked very openly about the horror that unfolded that day. So this is exactly what happened on the day that those boys lost their life. So on the 15th of June 2023, Dorman basically tells his mother he's having some really confusing feelings. At this point, his own mother, who obviously is very close to him and loves him, she said, you know what, you need to go and get some help. Maybe go to the little clinic. It's inside a Kroger shop in Claremont County. Go and talk to somebody about that. Go and have a conversation about how you're feeling. So he goes there after he leaves work around 9:30 a.m. Unfortunately, it seems that no one was actually at the desk. So he turns and walks away. On the way home, he picks up a 16-ounce can of Bud Light. Then after he gets back to his home, his family return from running some errands and his sons are apparently really happy to see him. They're not scared of him. This is not a man that makes them afraid. They enjoy their time with him. He sits with them and plays. They all play together. But Chad Dorman at one point calls his father. It's about lunchtime. And he cryptically tells his dad, Clayton is going to be the hardest one. Now, I would struggle if my son called me and said, their child, for example, is going to be the hardest one. I'd be like, what? What's going on here? And because of my background, that would be enough to actually go over and do something about it. And I'll tell you why, because when you've lost traumatically, as I have, to suicide, and you have heard some of the statements that are said by these individuals that might not directly suggest something terrible is about to happen, what you realise is eventually when something does happen that's terrible, there have been red flags that arguably it would have been helpful to pick up on, as I noted before. So professionally, if I heard a client say, so-and-so is going to be the hardest one, that would be enough for me to act, because I would be very concerned as an individual who has to think about safeguarding that something bad might happen. I always err on the side of caution. And if it was a member of my family, I'd just go over, because I would imagine there is something amiss. There is something untoward about the language being used here. I'm not, by the way, blaming his father in any way, shape or form. I'm just saying that I think when language is used like that, it's always important to act, because that is very unusual language to use. Nonetheless, after this phone call, he goes ahead, he has his lunch with his wife. He then tells his wife, this will be my last good meal. Now, we can all assume that he's either talking about that being his last good meal because he's going to end his own life, or even more sinister wise, he's saying this will be my last good meal because the rest of my meals are going to be in prison. It's as simple as that. So it's one of those two. And his wife's clearly worried about it. But equally, when we love our partners, even when they're struggling, we see the best in them. We see them not in their worst scenario, not in their worst day. We see them in their best times, the times that they spent with us in positive ways, and we weigh it all up, the good and the bad. And often, the good far outweighs the bad. So even though he's saying this stuff, she's probably thinking he's going through something, things are tough for him, maybe psychologically he's struggling, but she's equally going to be thinking, but this is the man I love and who loves me. And even though he's saying these strange things, he's still having lunch, he's still playing with the boys, she's probably hoping it is just going to pass. And she apparently noted that things did return to feel pretty normal, even though there were these strange statements. But between 1 and 3:30 p.m., he basically plays with the kids, he does some yard work, he's just going about his business. But then around 3:30 to 3:45, he begins to read the Bible to Hunter. He's apparently walking around the house with a Bible, mumbling, Chad knows what's right. Chad knows what's right. Now, that is a big red flag to me. And with somebody like myself, because I lost my dad to psychosis, and because my dad went through periods of psychosis at the end of his life, one of the things that you will note is this kind of behaviour. It's very unsettling, it's very insular, it's introverted, it's withdrawn, the person is in their own world. And it's not that you can't have conversations with them, but it's a little bit like speaking to somebody who's stuck behind glass. They might look at you, and they might even converse with you, but it feels like they're dead behind the eyes, and it feels like they can't quite connect and compute the conversations that you're having with them, no matter how rational. Because bear in mind, if you are going through a period of psychosis, and I'm not saying this guy is, I'm just drawing in the potential parallels, even when they are hearing logic, it's illogical because they're seeing the world from a completely different lens. And that can be really challenging for people who are around people with psychosis, because you're thinking this is so obvious that what you're saying is making no sense. And if you try to reason with them, they actually distrust you even further because they already feel suspicious of the world around them. So you telling them that they're not computing the world correctly just means that it feeds into that suspicion and paranoia further. So you can't win. And genuinely, when you have somebody in this circumstance, it is a moment to reflect and take an actual knowledge that you might need to get some extra help, because it can be very scary when somebody that you love starts talking in this manner. And the other thing is, when we look at a lot of cases cases, particularly where women have murdered their children, if you think about some of the cases that I've actually covered on this channel, you will note that they have often got themselves into a scenario where they start reading Bible verses, they start believing that what they're doing is the right thing, they're being ordered by God to kill their children. So we have to acknowledge that there are some threads of connection with cases like that. But the fact that he's talking about himself in the third person, Chad knows what's right, Chad knows what's right, it's alarming. Now, around 4 p.m., he does something that's really scary. He gets into the gun safe. And Laura, his wife, at this point says, "You're scaring me." And she must, in that moment, be thinking to herself, he's going to hurt himself. He's going to do something to himself. Because I do not believe for one second that Laura believed that Chad Dorman had the capacity and potential to murder his children. In fact, what I believe about Laura is if she had so much believed that he would harm a hair on their head, she would have gathered them together and left immediately. And that is what's so diabolically sad about this, that this loving mother is thinking about the man that she loves and is concerned about his well-being and what he may do to himself, not what he may do to the people that she loves most in the world. At this point, Chad actually says to her, "I'm just playing around." And then he says that he's going to go and have a lie down. But she is concerned enough about his change in state that she can physically see that she is really worrying he's going to harm himself, that she genuinely doesn't want him to be alone. So she actually goes with herself and her three boys into the master bedroom with Chad Dorman, and they all lie down for a nap. Now, after lying down, Dorman basically jumps up. He opens the gun safe. This is next to the bed. And he removes a Marlin Model 22 rifle from the gun safe. He then loads the magazine. And understandably, at that moment in time, everybody in that room, aside from him, is filled with horror. Laura, his loving wife, his boys, his loving children, they're screaming at him. They think he's about to kill himself. They're saying that they love him. They're begging him not to do anything to himself. Laura actually grabs the phone to call 911, but Chad Dorman grabs the phone, throws it across the room, and then he says to her, "It's too late." Now again, this is harrowing. This is terrifying. Nobody wants to witness this kind of thing play out in real life, in real time, because if you think you're about to lose somebody that you adore, even if it's at their own hands, of their own volition, it's terrifying beyond belief. But none of the children, and certainly not his wife, are thinking that he's going to threaten them. They're just thinking, how do we save you? And isn't that just psychologically so devastating that in the moment where he is thinking about ultimately executing three children, they are thinking about how to save his life? It is such a polarity that this is going on, that you have this pure, unadulterated love of this group of people versus this cold, calculating, mechanical evil that comes over this man. He then tells the boys that he loves them. He tells them that they're the best boys ever. And then he shoots Hunter Dorman. He shoots him twice in the bedroom. Laura, totally blindsided by this, starts to try to help Hunter. She's yelling at that moment in time for the other children to run because it suddenly hits her. He's not taking his life. He's taking her baby's lives. She knows if they don't run, they are not going to survive. Now, bear in mind, Laura's 14-year-old daughter, Alexis, Chad Dorman's stepdaughter, she's been in the living room. She's been watching the TV. She's heard this commotion going on, and she goes to the bedroom to actually figure out what's happening, and she sees Hunter get murdered. Immediately, she bolts, she runs, and she indicates that Clayton's gone out of the back door and that Chad Dorman's now following Clayton. So she's aware that he is actually chasing her brother and clearly is wanting to harm her brother. She runs outside. She tries to protect Clayton, but she just sees Chad running. He raises his rifle and then he just fires multiple shots as Clayton runs, desperately fleeing the man that gave him life, desperately fleeing the man that he thought was one of his best friends, his best mentors, his father. And she again witnesses Clayton fall as he's struck by the gunfire. Chad then approached Clayton. This is whilst he's injured, whilst he's already very badly harmed by the shootings. He knocks him to the ground and he shoots him in the head, and that kills him. So we're talking about this stone cold blooded execution. Alexis, horrified, then runs back. She runs through the residence. She picks up Chase, the youngest child, this baby basically. She starts to run. She starts to take her brother with her. But he sees her and he points that rifle directly at her head. And he basically says that he's going to shoot her if she doesn't drop Chase. She's in that situation where she has no option. She puts Chase down. Diamond points the gun at Chase's head. And to add even more torment to the horror I'm describing, the gun just clicks. He was out of bullets. Alexis is begging, please don't shoot me. Chase does what any little boy would do. He runs to his mummy, his protector. She's outside the home at this point. She's trying to give aid to Hunter. Laura and Chad Dorman then struggle over the weapon. She's bitten at this point. She's desperately trying to protect her one surviving boy. She puts her thumb over the end of the barrel just to try and stop the bullet. But she ultimately gets shot in the thumb. At this point, Dorman has actually gone ahead and reloaded the firearm. Ultimately, Chase is dropped. He's shot in the head by Dorman. He's executed by that one single shot. After each of those boys have been murdered by the man that they loved, Dorman goes and picks them up, just lays their bodies next to each other in the front yard. You can understand that when the prosecutors told that story, when it came down to what they wanted punishment-wise for Dorman, it was very simple. They wanted the death penalty. On June the 23rd, 2023, Dorman pled not guilty by reason of insanity. Now, his attorneys basically acknowledged that the acts that happened were horrific, but they said that he was suffering from a mental illness at the time and that he was profoundly sick. A defence expert actually claimed that Dorman was suffering from bipolar disorder at the time of the murders. It's actually quite surprising that, because bipolar disorder is not something that we would usually see in this kind of defence, because you really need a high bar when it comes down to a plea of insanity. It's actually really hard to reach that bar full stop. It's easier in the UK than it is in the States. You know, in the States, you have to really, really be out of your mind to be given the opportunity to plead that. I mean, there are so many people that suffer from bipolar disorder, whether that's type 1 or type 2. The point is that that is a pretty unusual defence, I would say. To talk about what we're discussing right now, which is the idea that if you have bipolar disorder, you might actually go ahead and murder your children, that, I guess, in my opinion, is not going to meet the bar at all. And another expert who was appointed by the court, they said no. Dorman doesn't have a serious mental illness. He certainly didn't have his judgment impaired in a way that would make us feel that he was profoundly out of his mind. And actually the quote was this: Mr. Dorman's careful execution of the murders, coupled with the statements he made to law enforcement after they arrived on scene, indicated that he appreciated the nature of what he did, as well as the wrongfulness and consequences of such. That was Dr. Carla Dreyer. They also said that he had never been diagnosed or treated for or prescribed medication for any mental health condition before the shooting. And this led to them saying this is not an individual who is suffering from something so severe that it would cloud his judgment to such a degree where he would not be able to compute the difference between right or wrong. The prosecutors also said that his statements that were given to the police and also to other people at the time and before the killings were inconsistent of someone suffering from delusions. And I completely understand why they've gone down that road, because at the end of the day, he's murdered three beautiful children in cold blood. Equally, I do think it would be unfair to throw out completely the idea that he could be dealing with some form of psychosis. Certainly when I've seen him in court appearances, there is something unusual about his body language. And unlike what we would expect, where we're considering sociopaths and psychopaths who very rarely show obvious emotion, I would say this man is somebody who appears to be trying to hold in emotion, but fails at times and actually looks like he is dealing with real anguish. So again, that plays more into this idea that there is something going on deeply within his psyche that may be problematic. Now, on the 2nd of August, 2024, he appeared in court for a surprise plea deal, basically, because he said he was not guilty by means of insanity. But in the end, he pled guilty to 3 counts of aggravated murder and 2 counts of felonious assault. In that appearance, he did make it clear to the judge that he understood everything that came with entering a guilty plea. And the aggravated circumstances at this point were dismissed as part of the plea deal. And that meant that he would not be considered for the death penalty. Victim impact statements, understandably, were deeply emotional. And they were at this point read out in court. Chad Doerman's stepdaughter, Alexis, and his wife, Flora, they had statements read on their behalf. They both emphasised how neither of their lives are ever going to be the same again. Laura's statement said that Chad had ripped away and destroyed forever the life she once knew. She said, "I grieve the loss of Clayton, Hunter and Chase every day. I grieve the life they never got to live." She talked about the emptiness and the silence that Chad created by killing the boys. She said that she grieves them every day and misses the little ways they would say, "I love you." Alexis, his stepdaughter, who was obviously close to Doerman, she said it was truly painful to see him going to prison for the rest of his life because she never thought he would do anything like this to his own kids and his family. She said, "Holidays without her 3 siblings will never be the same." She said, "You took their lives. Nothing will ever be the same again because of you." She said, "Softball will never be the same. You made me a good ball player. I always want to tell you because I know you'd be so proud of me. And Chad, I still work very hard on my grades. And I was on the honor roll this year." And isn't that just heartbreaking that you're just hearing in that moment that Chad Doerman to Alexis was a great stepdad? Someone who wanted her to succeed, someone who wanted her to work hard, do well, succeed in sports. He helped her get better at it. And ultimately she's sitting there knowing that the man that she loved, the man that believed in her, took 3 people of infinite meaning to her from her life and caused this chasm of pain and this void of emptiness that her brother's lives once filled. The conflict in that scenario psychologically is all but impossible to manage. How can you be this on one side, this amazing stepdad, and this on another side, this monster? Alexis also went on to say that Christmas mornings aren't the same anymore, and that when Doerman murdered her brothers, Clayton, Hunter and Chase, that he took her mum's life and her own too. And I completely connect with that, and I know all of you do. I know that every single one of us feel it, that if you were to lose 3 children in such a way, nothing will ever be the same. And one of the things that I think that people will look into this case and think is, why didn't he kill Alexis? Why didn't he kill his wife, Laura? And when it comes down to family annihilation, there are lots of different reasons why potentially people act out in this manner. So often we'll see family annihilation financially motivated when a man in particular feels that they're suddenly going to get found out and everyone's going to know that they had failed in certain ways. So economically, they'll have got into a mess. And they believe the easiest way to manage that, bizarrely, is to kill the family members so they don't have to feel the pain. That tends to be the excuse. And often those men will take their lives too. And they seem to believe that that's an easier way out than just acknowledging the need to go bankrupt and accepting that people aren't going to be very happy that they've been lied to. So the ego drives them, and the psychology of that ego, and to some degree the narcissistic traits within that, that certainly is a driving force. Then there's mental illness, where somebody doesn't necessarily compute what they're doing or believes that they're doing something better for their children, shall we say, because they think that something awful is going to happen because they're dealing with delusions. That can be a driver as well. often when it comes down to these very rare scenarios, but statistically the motivations behind them is to do with an anger, they're territorial, maybe a relationship's broken down, and they're looking at that ex-partner and they're thinking, you're not having what I gave you. And they know that ultimately they're gonna absolutely destroy the psychology, the mentality, the emotional experience, the rest of that person's life. And they want to use that as a punishment for them. It's more desirable to them to cause the ex the absolute agony of loss than it is to let their children live good lives. The feelings they have towards their children are just not as ferocious as the feelings that they have passionately in a negative way towards their ex. So that's another driver. What's interesting in this case is that, to all intents and purposes, Alexis clearly has a good relationship with her stepfather. Laura clearly thought she had a good relationship with her husband, imperfect, I'm sure, but nothing too terrible. And he seemed to have a good relationship with the children. So it doesn't nicely fit into any of those categories in particular. And it's also interesting to me when you think about the fact that he doesn't kill Alexis potentially because he doesn't believe that she belongs to him. At the end of the day, even though Laura is his wife and Alexis is his stepdaughter, he did not form them. Laura is a woman that he married. Alexis is a man he had a privilege to be a stepfather to, but that ultimately means territorially, they don't belong to him. They're not a possession of his. So it could be that the reason that he doesn't kill either of those is because he doesn't see that he has the same right to kill, which again plays back into a delusional belief system. She said, on top of those comments, that she will never hate Doorman. Also, she'll never forgive him for what he did. When his stepdaughter's statement was read out, he did show some emotion. And I would say, again, it's not like he wants to show emotion. It's quite the contrary. It's like he's holding back. He's very upright as well. And usually in these scenarios, you'd expect somebody to be quite slumped. And when they're not in that situation, you feel that they're trying to hold back. And I do get that feeling. I'm sure that some of you watching the videos of him will also feel that way. When it came down to the sentencing, well, we all know where it was going to go. He wasn't going to get the death penalty, but he was sentenced to life in prison without the chance of parole for count one, and the same sentence for count two and three as well. Plus, he got an additional 16 years for the counts of felonious assault. Those sentences are to be served consecutively with each other. This is to basically make it extremely clear that he is never going to take a breath outside. He's never going to be an individual who takes free breath on the outside of prison ever again. He's going to die in prison. He's going to be removed from prison in a box. It was actually said, it is unmistakably clear that you will spend the rest of your life in prison. Claremont County Common Pleas Judge Richard Ferenc told Doorman in court, there is no early release date for you. And that makes perfect sense because what he's done is ultimately evil. Equally, like I said, it will be interesting to follow this story and to know whether there is something eventually that comes out potentially about some psychosis or some mental health issue such as schizophrenia. Right now, that hasn't been released. But ultimately, like I said, whilst it won't excuse behaviour, maybe it will give more of an insight into his actions. Laura, the person who has lost most in this situation, the mother of those gorgeous boys, she released a statement and she said that she was absolutely in agreement with the state for the deal. She said, I am in full agreement with how the criminal case was resolved and the decision to end the criminal case with a plea and multiple life sentences brings some finality to the court case for my daughter and me. Laura said, no punishment will ever bring my boys back. Having a guarantee that he will spend the rest of his life behind bars is what is best for my family. Remember them as the three little boys who loved fishing, go-karting and swimming. Remember them as the boys who loved to have fun and were inseparable from one another. Their lives are not only about what happened to them. They're so much more than that. I love you, Clayton, Hunter and Chase. So powerful, because that's exactly what happens in these horrendous cases. We lose sight of what was and we concentrate on the very final moments, which are too terrible to even conceive of. and we missed the dash in between. There was a birth date, and indeed, sadly in this case, there was a death date far too young. But the years in between those were profoundly important and full of love. And if all we do is focus on the end, then it denies the meaning of what happened in between. I think that her words are beautiful, and I think it speaks volumes about who she is as a mother. Chad Doerman will spend the rest of his life in prison. Professionals have basically said that one of the things that's likely is he will literally be on suicide protocol for the rest of his life. They also believe that he will be in solitary confinement in a maximum security prison, which I guess, when it comes down to it, for many of us, would feel more hellish than being executed. The idea of being locked up in solitary confinement, potentially for 24 hours a day, that's like going to hell early. And I wonder at some point whether he will regret going ahead and making a plea deal where he gets to spend essentially the rest of his life, which is potentially a long life because he's a young guy, locked up in this way. Maybe it will change. Maybe he will one day be able to be with other prisoners. But if not, that may indeed be a fate worse than death. And I'm sure a lot of people 100% believe that that's exactly what he deserves, because when you draw down to the basic detail, there were three absolutely gorgeous, absolutely loved, absolutely thriving children who would have gone on to be good men. And gosh, we need good men. And instead, their story came to an end at the hands of a man who should have done everything in his power to do the very opposite. He should have been the person that they looked to in their moments of need. He should have been the person that they looked to when they needed protection. He should have been the person that advised them when they needed help and support. He should have been their go-to, just like Laura, their mother, was their go-to. I don't know how they, as in Laura and Alexis, are going to survive this. I trust that they will. And I hope that their lives will be gifted with beauty in spite of the horror. I think what Laura's words were in her statement demonstrate a woman who can reframe horror and refuse to allow that horror to cloud the beauty of what was. And I hope that from the beauty of what was comes the beauty of what can be. I'm sure that every single one of us wishes that for her too.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.